From UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation, this is Tales from the South. Recorded in front of a live audience every Tuesday night during dinner at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Sit back, relax, and let's reconnect with the power of a story.
It's early in the morning, she's got the breakfast on. Won't look at you, and suddenly I'm young.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Big Silver? Y'all like Big Silver? Composed of frontman Isaac Alexander, guitarist Brad Williams, bassist Mike Nelson, and percussionist Bart Angel, Big Silver was the winner of the 2000 Arkansas Times Musicians Showcase and has four studio albums, including the latest Max recording release, Tributary. Big Silver's music is available on iTunes. All right, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark can be heard on legendary bluesman John Weston's CDs, Got to Deal with the Blues and Blues at Daybreak. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? This week, our writers are all outsiders, whether of a region, a state, or a culture. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Alan Reese does not want to be transplanted south of the Mason-Dixon, and will end the night with Judith Gardner as she struggles to adapt to her new home's weather. But let's start the night with Frank Fusco as he heads south to the Delta and another world in A Day in the Delta.
Massa, please, Massa, sir, help me. I turn to find the source of this agonized plea. Sitting in the shade on the ground, his back resting against the side of the white-painted old store building, was an elderly black man. He was very decrepit and had either never seen better days in his whole life. My stomach knotted. I wasn't sure whether it was from being wrongfully addressed as Massa, meaning master, or from the sorrow of seeing another human so pitifully deprecate himself. What do you want? I asked him. Massa, give me $5 for wine. Please, Massa. You want money for wine? Yes, sir. Please, mister. I need wine. Sorry, I won't give you money for wine. But if you are hungry, I'll take you into the store and buy you a sandwich and something to drink, like orange juice. But I'm not giving you money for wine. No, sir. I needs money for wine. I muttered no and just left. This was near the end of an eye-opening but depressing day, which happened to be my first visit to the Delta region of Arkansas. Even though I had lived in Arkansas many years, my experiences with the state were limited to the northern half and occasional visits to Little Rock. The Delta was another world that I didn't understand. But one day I found myself driving my old truck from Mountain Home to a very tiny town deep in the Delta. I had an appointment at a large government facility for a job interview. The trip was uneventful until I started driving southeast of Pine Bluff, where civilization, as I knew it, fell behind and vanished at the end of my narrow two-lane road. Soon, two differences between my world and where I was now became apparent. The road bisected vast, flat expanses of cotton fields. Few structures were to be seen except for occasional large tin buildings where cotton was brought from the fields for processing. Surrounding the buildings were many tractors and large carts for hauling the freshly picked bowls. The only signs of habitation were occasional buildings with half-mile, mile, or two-mile spacings. Most frequent were small, unpainted houses. Hardly houses as we would envision the world to mean. More like shanties. There would be one, two, sometimes three in a row. Seldom more. The site reminded me of daguerreotype photographs from the 1860s, reproduced in history books. Invariably, an old black woman would be sitting on the shanty porch or the front steps, and several small children would be playing in the dust that passed for a yard. The word pickaninny came to my mind when I saw the children. I hadn't heard the word since my own childhood and never really knew what it meant. Probably a disparaging term for black children, I guessed, but the sight of the poor people and the shacks brought this bit of taut bigotry to mind. A mile or two from the shacks would be seen an occasional oasis in this desert of black soil and dust. Surrounded by trees and well-kept shrubs, one could spot a beautiful luxury residence not far from the blacktop. To myself, I opined, white folks and rich. There wasn't much else to see. Thousands of acres of flat black fields, cotton processing stations, shanties with old women and children, and occasional large beautiful homes where rich people lived. A few other vehicles passed by on the roads, but after a while I noticed something unusual with oncoming cars or trucks when they did pass me. Sometimes the driver would wave. Not unusual in any rural setting. Rural folks are universally friendly. But not all waved. After a while, it occurred to me that the only wavers were white. Black drivers weren't waving. Eventually, I started initiating the wave. White drivers returned the wave. Blacks didn't. There was no doubt. The stark contrast in wealth and the fraternal-like division with something so simple as a friendly gesture showed me I had entered a world where people were clearly defined by their color. Here I belonged to the white fraternity. I didn't like where I was. A roadside sign indicated the outskirts of the town I was seeking, but aside from the sign, there was little evidence of anything resembling a town. I pulled off the road and stopped only to be engulfed by a following cloud of dust that dirtied my clean job interview clothes in the non-air-conditioned truck. On a side road to my left were a few brown, unpainted buildings that might have passed for a business district in a scene from Gone with the Wind. Several old cars were parked in front of one of the stores. Driving up to the store, I could see the front door was open with only a sagging wood frame screen door as protection for the millions of mosquitoes that plagued the area. I parked and went up to the door. People could be heard talking inside. I opened the door and peered into the darkness. The large room was empty except for six elderly black men sitting in a circle on folding chairs in the center, obviously visiting. Wordlessly, they turned and looked at me. "Pardon me, gentlemen, I need directions." I asked how to find the facility where I had my appointment. None spoke. All just stared in silence. I waited an embarrassing minute, hoping one of them would speak. None did. I turned and left. As I turned to leave, I spotted a white building several hundred yards further down the road. I headed to that. The white building was an operating small grocery store with a single gasoline pump in front. I went in and was immediately gratified for its cool, air-conditioned interior. Looking around, I saw a small deli and meat counter near the rear. Approaching, I asked the white man behind the counter if he could make me a sandwich. "Of course," he said, "but give me a minute to wash." Puzzled by this, I looked at him. He said with a nodding gesture of his head, "I don't wash my hands for everyone, if you know what I mean." Looking in the direction of his nod and glance, I saw several customers, all black. I was liking this world less and less with every small experience. After he prepared my sandwich, I went to the cooler, picked up a carton of orange juice, and headed for the checkout counter. In line ahead of me were three or four black women. All had several small children. All of the women were stereotypically obese. I noted that the one checking out was paying with some kind of voucher slips, not cash. Since there were still a couple people ahead of me, I patiently began spending my time contemplating the tops of my shoes, waiting my turn to check out. A call of, "Sir, sir, come on up," broke my reverie. I looked up. The women in front of me were standing aside so I could check out ahead of them. The cashier, a white woman, said, "You don't have to wait for them." I considered protesting that this wasn't fair and I could wait my turn. But it was obvious. In this world, rules of common courtesy didn't apply. All that mattered was white or black. I wanted to leave this environment as soon as possible, so I allowed myself to exercise this white privilege and quickly checked out to head for my truck where I would eat lunch in the stifling southern heat and dust. As I rounded the corner of the store heading for the truck, I was about to get another lesson of life in this world. Master, Master, please, Master, help me, sir.
Frank Fusco lives in Mountain Home, Arkansas. He enjoys writing novels and what he calls vignettes of some of his more interesting life experiences. Tonight's reading is one of those experiences. In our next story, Alan Reese, a Westerner, is unhappily transported to the South and culture shock in Tardy.
Culture shock can be a paralyzing experience. One of my biggest, perhaps the biggest, was moving to Arkansas. My formative years had played out west of here, a dry and windy place with a huge sky and terrible heat and cold. It's known as the Sand Hills, and it's comprised of cattle ranches, barbed wire, buffalo grass, canyons, prairie dogs, rattlesnakes, and cactus. Sand Hill inhabitants are leathery and hardworking. They have time for little else. They rely solely upon themselves, and that is precisely the way they want it. It grates upon them that politicians and businesses in places elsewhere affect their lives. In this harsh and prickly place, I explored and hunted a countryside redolent with history. I worked at the rodeo, argued and fought over trivialities. I bucked 90-pound hay bales for 50 cents an hour. I drank illegally in a Silverfront bar and once witnessed from a corner a ghost god-awful bar fight. And one silvery fumbling night, an angel named Wanda presented me with a gift previously only dreamt of. My first culture shock was provided at no cost to me by the military. Screaming sergeants and blinding sweat became my world, even as the metropolis outside the fence remained invisible. Until one night, as I walked my post, mindful of the treachery of saboteurs and the reality of scorpions, I was struck with lights, the glow of a city, headlights, building lights, everywhere flashing and moving. It was overpowering. It had been there, of course, but I hadn't been ready. And then suddenly it was an explosive sensory overload. It was big, bigger than all of my experience. I had stood on a midnight hill and watched a full moon fade stars and silver light the world, but that was my world. This one shockingly diminished it. After that night and the others that followed, I returned to the Sand Hills only as a visitor. I found them lacking, and it was a sad discovery, for I love it there. But I had traveled, met people, visited other countries, experienced different cultures. I learned other languages and tasted exotic foods. I not only saw the lights, but reveled in them. My mental DNA grew silently and found some sophistication. Where I had been dismissive, I was now curious. What might have been annoyance was now humor. Ultimately, my life found its way. Marriage and career, children, mortgages, illness and death, joy and fright, and the inevitable gray hair. I was well-rounded, educated, reliable, smug. And then came Arkansas. The South. I'd never been there, and I didn't really understand what the South meant. A country I understood, a tribe, a cult, hell, the Kiwanis. But the South had a context I found elusive. I knew bits about it, of course. I knew there had been some war down there, and I recall something about cotton or maybe flax, I don't know. But most of what I had seeped in were images, overalls, sprawling hounds, hills and hollows, feuds. It's all I had, and I was moving there, and I was opposed. Friends and family were not there. I considered myself a Westerner. Why would I want the heady aroma of jasmine when I can have the earthiness of a stockyard? But we moved, and my attitude preordained unhappiness. I saw what I wanted to see: high crime rates, miserable humidity, backbreaking poverty balanced by ludicrous wealth, poor education systems, insects that even my nightmares wouldn't touch. I built a ridiculously endless bitch list, and I clung to it. I pitied me gloriously. Conversations with friends were vitriolic. Every observation was biting and acidic. My wife tired of it. My sons laughed at me. It began to embarrass me, but I didn't know how to change it. But I did change it, with help from a very unexpected source, a young child named Tardy, whom I learned of from a radio news item, ironically from a rural area of the state. This is what I heard. A young couple was celebrating the birth of a baby boy. His name was Tardy. He had ignored his due date and came late into the world, so he was named Tardy. That story swept over me like the city lights I had seen years ago, but this time I knew what it was, an epiphany. I loved it. Tardy was a name imbued with joy and personal meaning, a name with a story, and I relished every aspect of it. I thought a lot about that story, about the unfettered imagination and gentle humor involved. I was fascinated with the freedom of thought Tardi's parents displayed and how they celebrated in a manner distinctly their own. Clearly, they had no thought that suggested this name would burden his formative years. His peers will know and accept him as Tardi. Teachers, neighbors, family will know him as Tardi without pause. I thought about the Sandhills. Had I been named Tardi many miles ago, I would have been a sheep in a herd of Black Angus. Something unexpected, something to be viewed through slow, squinty Sandhill eyes. I would have been that kid with the odd name rather than the Reese boy. I'm certain, had I been named Tardi, my formative years would have been different. I thought about me. I had considered myself tolerant, and that notion had proven false. Once revealed, it begged the question, stay me or work on a different me, experience and celebrate, or view and judge? And with that question, it struck me that I had already decided. I wasn't suspicious of the name Tardi. I was enchanted by it. So I reversed the critical eye inward with difficulty. The mind's mummies move with aggressive reluctance. In the months following Tardi's birth, I explored and I chatted. Mena, Eureka Springs, Harrison, Boxley Valley, Calico Rock. This is an astounding place. Every drive is one of discovery. Every curve reveals another compelling image. The color green dominates. Trees, wildflowers, melodic birds, and dead armadillos flourish. In the Sandhills, I drove County Road 15. Here, I encountered Lower Steel Bend Road, Colonel Bockham Lane, Blue Jay Hollow. I came to feel that a rural road with a name has an aura. There's an undertone of warmth and residence. You are close to home, and that makes it personal. Sandhill roads were functional and efficient and devoid of personality. They generated no curiosity whatsoever. But here, I do wonder about the story behind Walker's Corner Road. I encountered friendliness everywhere. Not the cautious, polite friendliness of the Sandhills, but one that is immediately open, interested, and receptive to humor. I found a rich and varied culture in small towns, many of which are true destinations. Music and art and creativity in various forms are widespread. Personal uniqueness is accepted, and that is the crux of Tardi's lesson to me. I am neither sociologist nor anthropologist, so these thoughts are distinctly non-academic. My maturation was influenced by the culture of the Sandhills. Wherever my genetic inheritance may have led me, it was subject to local judgment, the pressure of a local culture to fit its mold, tough, reticent, reliable, predictable. The reward of conformance was acceptance. In contrast, what I sense here in the South is a tendency to allow personalities to develop generally free of cultural influence. Simply put, the traits you are born with is the person you tend to become. There's no mold to be measured against. Uniqueness or eccentricity are not viewed through slow, squinty Sandhill eyes. Thus, imaginative parents and a child named Tardi. So how am I doing? Not bad. I'll never be comfortable with y'all. And Conway's toad suck days leaves me baffled. But I can throw down catfish or fried pickles or whole hog barbecue with ease. I know that Highway 161 between Scott and England is incredibly photogenic. I know that if you haven't eaten or seen cottons, you are incomplete. And now I know that incident back in the 1860s was not civil. It was invasive. I'm not a Southerner, but I'm working on it. Thanks, Tardi. I hope you have a great life. You already have a great name.
Retired and transplanted to the South, Alan Reese has summited difficult mountains, then wept with emotion and exhaustion, tied cherry stems into granny knots with his tongue, and most importantly, has kept every friend he ever made. In our final story of the night, Judith Gardner moves from California to Arkansas, and then comes her first tornado in The Winds of Regret.
The tornado is 5 minutes from Maumelle. I'm a goner. I am so sorry I never bought you a light bright and that I grounded you for using the F word. I never taught you to pray. I never taught you how to handle money. I never taught you how to use power tools. Your cooking stinks and it's all my fault. And I'm so sorry I yelled at you when I was trying to teach you to drive and ride a bike. I sobbed through the phone to my daughter, Erin, in Charleston. Who are you, and what have you done with my mother? It was inevitable that this California girl was in for it the first time I saw a tornado slice through Little Rock. Longtime residents had gloried in regaling me with tales of tornadoes past that had taken out whole neighborhoods, harvest foods, and sent cars catapulting across Main Street. Well, spring of 2008 seemed fairly tame to me until that night when I was visiting friends in Kamek Village. Something didn't seem quite right. It was raining a little, but the vibes in the air gave me what they call down here the willy-nillies. Californians are big on vibes, and when you get one, you better act fast. So I made a polite but speedy exit and zoomed across the bridge to Maumelle. It was the most astonishing light show ever. Even San Francisco nightclubs in the 1960s couldn't compare. Miles-long, purple, serrated bolts cracked the sky and splattered light on the river. I could hardly keep my eyes on the road, but my hands stayed firm on the wheel to keep the winds from blowing my little Toyota into the roiling waters below. Get the heck home. It may be pretty, but it's dangerous, and you are so in for it. Alone, you and your little dog, too. Screeching into the garage, I sped straight for the TV. The networks were ablaze with reports as the tornado ripped up from the southwest through Bryant and Benton, then straight into Kamek Village, where I was visiting not 15 minutes before. But I was prepared. When I first landed here in Arkansas, I put all of my bleach bond faculties to work and devised a plan. If I'm going to die in a tornado, let me go happily and in comfort. Keep it simple. In the linen closet, I placed a bottle of Perrier, a corkscrew, and a cheap California Pinot Noir. Oh, and some tennis shoes and a leash and some milk bones for my beagle, Simon. Feeling empowered, I later stocked the bathroom with a comforter and pillows to cover my head if my dog and I had to cower in the tub, a crowbar and an axe in case I had to bust my way out from under a bone-crushing pine tree, tuna, dog food, flashlight, peanut butter, a can opener, first aid kit, extra shampoo, and canned ravioli. Cranking up the TV to full volume, I grabbed Simon, who was sleeping on the forbidden sofa, and ran for the bathroom. Yanking open the linen closet, I pulled out the comforter and pillows. The wine was long gone. And threw them in the tub along with the dog. I grabbed the peanut butter and the crowbar from under the sink, and along with my cell phone, I leaped in the tub and slammed the door shut. That was when I made the call that my daughter will never let me live down. Simon was starting to squirm among the pillows, scruffling around and around, trying to nest. He was distracted by the open jar of peanut butter and licking it off my fingers, sticking his nose deeper into the jar to get bigger portions. I wasn't going to fight him. I'd share my last drop of peanut butter any day with the most loyal, true blue man I've ever known. Mama, Aaron squeaked, I can hardly understand you. Are you eating peanut butter again? You're not going to die. You can't. You haven't bought me a Light Bright yet. She knows most of the time not to argue with me when I'm insane. Yes, I am. I am so dead. And I never took the time to tell you how sorry I am. Sorry for what? Everything I ever did or didn't do. I'm sorry I divorced your wretched father and that you never had a daddy. I'm sorry your hair turned green when I tried to give it new life with that cheap box of hair color. I'm sorry for all the times I made you eat fish and pork chops and that I read whole passages out of Grapes of Wrath to make you feel guilty. I should have let you eat more French fries. The sirens are blaring. I hear a train. Oh, God, all hope is dead, and so am I. They'll find us in a few days, decomposed, reeking of peanut butter. By now, the dog is standing on his hind legs, pounding on the shower to get out. My cell phone was exploding as friends and family tried to reach me from both coasts. Not being a drama queen by any stretch, I continued. Vaya con Dios, my precious baby girl. I have never loved anyone as I have loved you. I'll wait for you in our next life, and we will be safe. You'll have a daddy and never have to eat pork chops. It will be in Mexico or somewhere where it's always warm and the winds are just gentle kisses. Feel my love when you look into the eyes of your firstborn child. I was never perfect, but I always thought my love for you was. Mama? The cell phone died. If you think this was maudlin, can you imagine the conversation if I had found that bottle of wine? The TV, still at full volume, started giving reports that the tornado was bypassing Maumelle. With stiff knees from crouching in the tub, I cautiously slithered out and headed for the living room. The house phone rang. It was my neighbor across the street checking in on me. She comforted and reassured me that we were not in danger. She told me I can always come to them. They were there for me, always. Southerners to the bone, just checking in on their neighbors. I'll bake them a pie in the morning. It's what Southerners do. Pie. Pie. No matter how you say it, its significance runs as deep as that river I cross each day. I won't even use the ready-made crust. I'll make it with my own hands and set it in the kitchen windowsill to cool. And when I take it to them, the screen door will slam behind me, resounding the unmistakable protection of the Southern home. I called my daughter from the house phone to tell her we survived. There was a lot of peanut butter involved, but we were indeed alive and well. I didn't put in the part about how I really wasn't sorry I divorced her father, or that if I had to, I would read Steinbeck until her ears fell off, if that's what it would take to make her more grateful for all she had. You ever gonna get me a light bright? Oh, and by the way, Mama, your love, it's perfect. Sleep tight.
A writer and artist, Judith Gardner finds her subjects in the broad landscape of Southern character and sensibilities. She lives in Maumelle, Arkansas, and still eats peanut butter even after all that. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.